Accession number 30394, reel 6.
But there were... Oh, one thing I remember about the weather was that sunset came very quickly. One minute it was full daylight, the next, after a few seconds, it seemed it was night. And there would be a smell coming through the air which seemed more noticeable at night, and it was a smell of spicy cooking, plus, above all things, the fuel used for Indian cooking, which was cowpats. Made into something like a chapati size, but thicker, and then dried in the sun. And that burns very well, but slowly. It burns almost like peat, but it leaves a definite smell in the air. And I'm cursed with a sense of smell. But certainly in the morning it was nice to wake up to a freshness. And I can't recall things like dew, but it was certainly... And I remember one afternoon in Bilaspur, laying on my bed, the siesta time, we used to call it, just laying there, and then out of this eye I could see this black insect crawling down the edge of the wooden bed. They were wooden beds with a crisscross of string. It was a scorpion. And I was off that bed and onto the other side of the tent in a split second. And they said, "Jesus, Ken, we never thought you'd make an athlete." But of course, the sun was coming in one end of the tent, and that was throwing a bigger image of the scorpion. I don't know whether it was a deadly one, but we soon jumped on it. That's another thing about India. In the morning you'd wake up and all over the hut would be a tap, 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 because people were putting their boots upside down and knocking out any insects. And in Bilaspur we had kites, or crates, small black, about that long, foot long, venomous snakes, you know, could have been a problem. But they, apart from the scorpions, I don't think the animals bothered me. I used to quite enjoy going through a market and seeing cows or bulls wandering around. It seemed normal.
Before the war finished, during your airborne training, mm-hmm. was there any training for specific operations in jungle conditions?
No. I think Bilaspur, they accepted that it was jungle. It wasn't the very densest of jungle, but it was pretty jungle. And I thought my impression now is that they thought you're living in it, therefore you're used to it. But we didn't have any special things. Oh, this is jungle, you've got to do this, and you've got to go in single file and all that. In fact, I thought that we were going into Japan, which doesn't have that much jungle, does it?
Had you been given any information about the Japanese themselves?
No. The only thing we knew about the Japanese is what we'd read in newspapers occasionally, that they were all of poor sight and they had to wear spectacles, and they were very, they disregarded, you know, they were cruel, as it were. That's perhaps not the right word, cruel, but savage. No. I suppose somebody somewhere did, but we were only, you know, junior ranks. I think nowadays, in the army, the junior ranks have kept up to date with what's going on.
What had been your reaction to the end of the war and the VJ Day?
Well, we only learnt of it through listening to All India Radio. It would be easy to say there was a sort of combined, that's it. But in the back of our minds, we were living in a semi-jungle, and that was it. Maybe after 3 or 4 days we felt, oh, we'll be going home now. Not that we were, because we weren't. But no, I don't remember. I think we had an evening at the regimental apology for a canteen and a bit of a sing-song. And we had certainly a can of beer each, given away free, but not a lot of feeling. Mind you, I mean, you're talking about a chap of 20, 21, 22, and he doesn't have deep thoughts, except he's thinking about going back to Blighty. That's what he really wants to do. But it was not to be.
You mentioned a bit earlier off the tape, I think, about Wavell and his plan to extract Britain from India without upset. Would you ever talk a bit more about...
His son said it was, as far as he was concerned, a well-planned... plan. It took into account all the things, the differences in religion, the fact that the Muslim League was then flourishing, also the policing, the soldiering of the different parts, and he gave the impression that when Britain withdrew from India, it would be gradually. It would not be overnight, we've got Pakistan and India. It would be almost without too much publicity. And that one day, India would be ruled by India and not by two countries. Well, I don't know whether you know, but of course they even kept the secret about the Pakistan-Indian borders secret until it was announced. However, that's politics. Attlee had decided that India must be given up, which is fair enough. Same applies to Iraq now. We need to get out slowly, unobtrusively, and once we're sure that a certain province or area is safely policed, then we can quietly go away. But politicians won't be like that, will they?
What was your own feeling as to the British withdrawal from India and the separate the division of the?
No, I think at the time I came back in January about March of 1947, March or April, yes, and that didn't happen till August. And I think I was still then settling back to a normal life as a civilian. I don't think I knew about it, but I don't think I had any deep thoughts. No, it wasn't until I got a bit older.
Had there been any question of your staying on in the army?
I didn't think really about it. I quietly thought about it and immediately thought, no, I don't want to be that. Because of my father's associations with the territorials, you know, he was a part-time soldier. And I was quite happy with that. So when I came out, I was a civilian. And then it was David Williams. No, it wasn't. It was somebody tried to get me, and they wouldn't have me. And then David Williams said, he was a friend of the family, wasn't he? Would you like to go in the infantry? And I thought, no. So we went down several times to Royal Sussex headquarters, and the RSM there persuaded me to join. He called you Mrs. Flint. He saluted you. Yes. You don't maybe remember, but I do.
Yes, I do. Constantine.
No, that was the CSM. No, I'm talking about old Spud. Anyway, it was a good RSM, and he persuaded me to join, so I went in the Royal Sussex TA, which was related to the Islingport Volunteer Rifles, eventually became the Queen's Regiment, and eventually became the Princess of Wales Regiment, and I was at the barracks at Canterbury when she took over as Common Colonel-in-Chief of the Princess of Wales Regiment. So I'm linked to her, so I'm on Diana's side.
You were called up to Aden, did you say?
Yes.
1960.
This was 1965. Well, 64 when I joined the Everready. This was, who was that chap with the duffel coat and the pipe? Wilson, yeah. He started a reorganisation of the army. And the idea was to reduce the number of regiments and make it more, the whole thing more efficient. So we had to complete a form saying, a declaration of intent. So I thought, well, here I've... Oh, no, I'm leaping ahead of myself. Now, I joined the Territorial Army Emergency Reserve because we got a little bit of extra bonus every year, and we needed money bringing up those children. So I did that. And then the rumour spread that you're going to be called up. And we thought, ah, it's a load of rubbish. Easter Saturday, 1965, and it came through the door. OHMS. You know what that is. You're called up. And that was it. I wasn't best pleased. I don't suppose you were. So I reported to Canterbury, and a week's refresher training, and then we're off to Aden. But because in the Royal Sussex I'd been in the regimental signals set up, I was put onto signals work, so I didn't have to shoot any dissidents.
Well, you didn't shoot anybody anyway. Oh. You took peacekeepers rather than...
Yes, it was a peacekeeping mission. And it was... I think we did a good job. One of my thoughts is... This will give you a clue to my state of being or mind. Aden was then a free port. There was no form of tax or anything on any goods. So you could buy liquor for all half the price. So when we came back...
You weren't allowed to buy it to bring out of the country.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah. So he bought a plastic water bottle.
Two plastic water bottles.
And he filled them with whiskey and put them in his rucksack.
I don't think we... The boys were very happy, but still I brought other things for them.
Yeah, books that they couldn't read.
Well, of course they were from right to left. That's how they read.
Yes, but they weren't even in English.
No, I know. But I have to try... Well, they all... they've all got a...
And hats, you brought them back there.
Oh, yes.
Mm. How long were you there for?
6 months. It was lovely, and that's something you should do one day. Go abroad and live in a... amid the barren rocks of Aden, and then come back to England. Drive along the country lanes, see the greenness and the hills, and oh.
How were the British received by the locals?
Very well, I think. I think we were regarded as peacekeepers. Further up country, in what is now the Yemen, there were tribes who were causing trouble. But then, that's part of the world, isn't it? It is tribes who have not slowly integrated into a nation that cause some of the trouble. Now, half of your blood comes from a tribe, doesn't it? Those bloody Scots buggers off.
No.
But they have integrated into Great Britain. If they want to go back to being Scotland as a nation, fair enough. But not different tribes. But that's the trouble in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think. There are still... tribal loyalties and things, and you do not cure it by clamping down on it. You cure it by very slow methods. More coffee, please. Now, am I leading you astray?
During the war itself, what had been your attitude towards the Germans?
If I'd analysed my brain, I would have been a little bit frightened of seeing a soldier in a field grey uniform with one of those helmets covering his neck. And I would have had to summon up all the courage I've got to use the weapon in my hand. It would not have been hate. It would have been self-preservation. I would have fought against him. During the war, there wasn't a lot of time to have deep thoughts about the enemy. They were the enemy. You know, that's it. If we're talking about enemy, sometime, I think it was early 44, there was a big ex-army exercise in southeast England. which was actually to give troops experience of fighting in built-up areas against the Germans. And one morning we looked out of our billet in Dover and there were German soldiers, actually they were British soldiers in German uniform, advancing up the street towards us. And I don't think we panicked. I think we realised quite quickly they were friendly. Looking back, they were marching in the British style, you know, section by section, with a point section in front. No hate, I don't think. No. And I suspect that those that fought in Spitfires and Hurricanes and so on, I don't think they hated the Germans. Very difficult. I can't speak entirely for the people of France, but I do remember one thing. The Germans, the Wehrmacht, and if you look at the vehicle number on their army transport, W, H and several figures. And this woman said to me, when we saw them driving through the village, we saw double V H, and we called them double Vash, double cows. So I don't think they really hated them. I think there was not a sense of unreality, but it's accepted.
How, looking back now, how do you view the war as a whole?
Inevitable, in a sense. I think things were never really sorted out after the First World War. I think the League of Nations fell down somewhere along the road, and then who was the Prime Minister before Chamberlain, when we were in the sort of period of you could say it's inevitable. But the only thing about saying any war is inevitable is that people take that as a, well, that's the answer to it. We must accept a war. So looking back, the Cold War was avoided. I did not have to report again to Dover Castle and, worst of all, leave a family behind. I told you what to do in the event of an atom bomb, didn't I?
Yes.
I bet she's forgotten now.
No. We had a partial underground part to the house that we lived in, and the freezer was in there, and the bathroom was in there, and the camping cooking stove was in there, so we had to go in there, and the coal hole was in there, open the window and put coal in the little gap to filter it, and we'd have water, because I'd filled the bath with water and a cooking camping stove and food, but I would have had to have cooked an awful lot of it because it would have gone up because there'd been no electricity.
Knowing that meanwhile I was safe underground at Dover.
Well, I was practically underground, wasn't I?
It's a big thought. It's more, well, the best way sometimes to fight a war is to dig in and do nothing. But stay armed, to stay alert.
Uh, How did you find the country when you got back from India?
Ah, Sally used to say that because I've started on. I've got all sorts of half finished books around the house. I found it visually slight changes. All the windows which had had sticky paper to stop them shutting, you know, to.
Shattering when the bombs dropped.
Yeah, they'd all gone. There were fewer uniforms about, although there were some. But rationing was still on, very much a thing, rationing.
Well, not until the 60s did we lose it altogether.
I remember one thing, walking into our house after having lived in the countryside for years, thinking how small it was. It was like being in a rabbit hutch almost. Now I think I was just happy to be out of the army, having done my bit, and still annoyed with those buggers. And there was a dance hall cum bar in Brighton, and I'd been in the army from the age of 18 until, what, for 5 years. And I went there once with some pals, and we went in and they said, "Hey, you're too young, get out." And I said, "No." So I told them my, you know, army history. I was about to go back to Lewis and change into uniform and medal ribbons and all, but I didn't have to. They let me in. But this place, not the region, I don't know. It was the days of spivs and, you know, and this place did have a reputation for being a boozy, troublemaking place. We've got a son who's in the police now, sorry. But I think because I was an adolescent when I joined up and I came back as an adult, that I don't have any great deep feelings. I was a little bit unhappy at the thought of all the Holocaust and the number of displaced persons who were around, and there was not a great deal of positive information on that. I think I felt at the Nuremberg trials, that the criminals, you know, the guilty ones, should be put down. And the other thing was that the war was over and I got no particular job to go to, so I went farm labouring for a year. So I was too busy absorbing that. Spring on the farm, summer, autumn, winter. And you learn a lot about life if you farm. If you see a whole year of farming life, you learn about seeds growing, the world growing. You learn a lot of important things, which you don't get paid much.